idea of that, and what are the causes?
Can I just say
something? Well, no, we can't blame that. No, no, this wasn't yesterday, this was 7.5 years ago. Okay. good morning, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members. We're going to take up where we left off yesterday with consideration of the department's responses to submissions on the legal practice bill. When we finished yesterday, we were dealing with clauses 7 together with 14, 12. Help me here, Mr. Skosana. Yes. Have I got it correct?
Yes.
All right. Then we're in your hands.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. Good morning. We'll continue with the fundamental principles, the big ticket issues, and when we did our debrief in the afternoon, we thought that we'll just today, just before we start, just highlight to this committee once more that the bill as was presented, as tabled, it's a fundamental shift from all the previous bills. It is a compromise bill. There were lots of trade-offs that were taken into consideration. At one point we have been so far apart between ourselves, the GCB, and the legal profession. This bill signifies there were largely major consensus on the principles which have been articulated. But what we wanted to bring this out, we did not dump those principles. The principles of merger, the issues of paralegals, the issues of senior status, the issues of training, if you see this bill, it retains the article training arrangement, it retains the tutelage, but it provides a mechanism. The council is going to be the main body that is going to drive the transformation outcome of this, of all these aspects that we could not resolve on. And we said, we have talking for more than 14 years trying to find consensus on what is the best form of training, what is the best form of admissions, whatever, and we've been going from pillar to post. We then agreed that we must establish a very perspective and transformative process to advance the transformation. And that vehicle is the council. Council is not going to set the fees. Council is going to basically commence the process of putting in place a transformating a legal profession that will basically fit the benefit that is considered the constitution. It is from that perspective that there was a need for participation from all the stakeholders, because it takes for the agenda. Now, if you are going to exclude other people from the council, then that agenda will be lost. So we thought we must give that background, that the bill as is basically is both transformative in areas and both set out the mechanism and the process in the vacuum to attain major transformation outcomes that are going to come. And it's also from that perspective that we did not want the council to get paralyzed because they could not agree on fundamental issues and end up not being dysfunctional and cannot be resolved. So you have taken all those things that you are going to deal with, access to justice, like the issue of fees, whatever the mechanism. You leave them on the council, and the very same council that must help the people become dysfunctional, then you have basically frustrated and thwarted all the efforts to transform the process. We thought that background is very important, just to keep at the back of the mind as we continue. And the minister did in his presentation to Parliament, he went twice and did clearly articulate that this vacancy is the only viable option to move forward in the legal profession after we've been there in the trenches for so long and could not come out. So we thought it's for us, we must come out to Parliament, people must know what's happening, and come with a bill but provide a vacancy that should take us forward, etc. I'll let my colleagues to add on that overview before I then flag the other principles.
Yeah, thank you. Just one or two little issues to add on to that. There has been criticism, and you'll see it in the comments as well, that the bill isn't transformational enough, doesn't contain the detail. What about vocational training? Why isn't that spelled out? The reality that we face is what JV has just sketched. These details have to come out in the negotiations during the Transitional Council, the light of the Transitional Council. The bill will also democratize the structures, and as was said yesterday on numerous occasions, I think it's an evolutionary process. I just want to make that point. It's an incremental process. I just wanted to add those two aspects to what JV said. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're still dealing with key issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We thought one of the
key issues that we must just get closure on, which also related to the issue of the independence of the profession, is the minister's power to make regulations. One, in the scheme of the bill, we have provided two mechanisms. One, most of the aspects that flows from the regional council, the transitional as well as the permanent council, allow the minister to process those agreements on concessions by regulations. So the council will advise the minister. The minister will make regulations after consultation with council. One principle we've brought in this bill is that all those regulations must be approved by Parliament. Because we wanted to argue before Parliament that since the bill is transformative, since provided vehicle, Parliament must have an oversight in terms of those aspects. So it's not a purely highly delegated function to a minister. So the minister does not deal with the student matters them alone. So we think therefore that the argument from the submission that the minister have unfettered powers in terms of making regulations, it's properly addressed by the fact that Parliament is always in the equation. The minister, and there's also a time frame, the minister must make regulations within a particular period, they must come to Parliament. So to the extent that there may have been a series of overkill, whatever, Parliament becomes the ultimate vote to resolve those issues. We have thought that it may be helpful as we continue, perhaps to look at and if the committee will be amenable there to look at to distinguish between those regulations which are mainly technical, which do not require Parliament, and those which are fundamental that will require Parliament, so that when we look at the powers in the bill of the ministers to make regulations, may look at those that we don't want to bother Parliament with, so them, and they are not. There's no contestation between government and the profession. The minister can then make those ones after consultation with the profession, and then pick up those ones which are fundamental and which there are fears that they basically seek to triumph over the independence. We bring them to Parliament. That was the first option. What we thought was that created a two-pronged approach, non-contentious, technical after consultation, fundamental in consultation, approval by Parliament.
Now,
we also take leave from what this Parliament have approved in terms of similar other precedents in terms of in consultation. If you create the in consultation, as is suggested, then it may be desirable that you create a deadlock breaking mechanism, because obviously in consultation presupposes concurrence.
Yeah.
And now Parliament may wish to look at whether they keep in consultation or they keep the power to approve whatever is after consultation, but that will leave to Parliament. We thought that we may, those principles may further kind of address the concern that the Minister has got powers to make many regulations, and we thought that could basically assist in moving forward with the concerns raised around the power to make regulations. But we felt that there are two powers to make regulations. The power to make regulations, the council has power to make rules. And that answered basically what GCB was saying about. GCB said when they make the presentation, we need to distinguish between issue of management and issue of governance, regulatory and governance. We believe that the bill is very clear. Issues of governance and management and operational are dealt by the council in terms of the rules, in terms of rules. Issues of regulation are dealt by Parliament and the Minister in terms of acts and regulation. And it would be very cumbersome to delegate to the council, which represents self-interest, to make regulation. Therefore, leave them with the rulemaking powers on matters that are within their purview, which are management, how they're going to do the registration of people, how they're going to go to court, and all those things, the day-to-day organization. The minister, parliament, they're not, just nobody wants to regulate the professions. We don't regulate them now, but obviously, there are aspects that are beyond governance, which require regulation at a higher level, etc. So that's the principle of regulation I wanted just to...
Could we just note, I mean, what the GCB is saying is not exactly what you're reflecting. They say, and I agree with them, you cannot take away from people the right to form voluntary organizations.
Yes.
And in their view, what a voluntary organization does is management and governance, and that we cannot take that away from them, which implies that the GCB remains and the LSSA, and I think that's absolutely right. The question to me is simply what comes about that. And you know, you created the single. But I think what you've just said is obviously not their position, because you think that the council should also do the governance and management via rulemaking, and the minister and parliament do the regulation. So there's a quite profound difference. That's just to note.
The next fundamental issue that we think, so after that relates to community service and training, whatever, will be dealt with regulation. So the debate I've said in terms of how Parliament guides or take a position about the Minister's powers will affect those aspects. The next aspect, which is very fundamental, which have been raised here, relates to Clause 342. And Clause 342 basically allow for the first time that advocates take briefs direct from the clients, the members of public. We obviously you'll understand that look from the bar, independent bars, etc. There's a general acceptance of the development, because yes, the independent association, others feel that it's going to enhance access to justice. GCB, independent bar. Yes, they're open to it because the interviews will open access to justice. GCB basically want the provisions to be deleted from the bill, because it will interfere with the referral principle. With the referral principle. Yes, the Law Society is also in support. Partly there have been mixed views, which indicates that there are different views amongst its members around those aspects, whatever. But how it is couched, Chair, is also a matter which will evolve with time. The provision does not say that it should happen without any parameters. And therefore, the fact that it will allow advocates to take money direct from the public, while they are not holders of any faculty fund, has been raised.
Mm.
And the issue that it will undermine the referral, etc. We think those are aspects that can be dealt with over time, and by the profession, and by the council. All that the bill does creates the possibility for that to happen when circumstances allow that process to happen. And it will be led by the council. So it's a matter that the GCD, the Independent Association, and the attorneys will basically grapple with, engage with, and come to a conclusion. We feel that for us be more accessible to the public, whatever. This is instances where matters can be taken directly. And what the categories of those instances can be further defined, can be further refined. I'm saying, for example, if there's an advocate appeal pro bono where no money change hands, why if the advocate wants to do pro bono, but the attorney does not do any pro bono, you still have to go violate where set up. All I'm saying is that the circumstances and the parameters are left to the profession to define.
Mr. Schaefer, hang on. Mrs. Schaefer, and then you, Mr. Emerson.
Thank you. I mean, how can we, I mean, no advocate's going to go into practice to do purely pro bono work. It's not going to happen, unless they're multimillionaires and can afford to do it and are very community-minded. But how can we insist that attorneys who take money from the public directly have to have fidelity fund certificates up front, but we want to leave the issue of the advocates to evolve? I don't agree with that. I mean, if people are taking money from the public, then the public needs to be protected equally if advocates are getting it directly as well as attorneys. So I don't think we can, you know, we can debate whether we should allow it at all or not, but if we do allow it, I really don't think it's right to allow an advocate not to have some kind of protection for the public.
Before you answer, Mr. Ambrosini.
Thank you. Just a question for clarity, and then perhaps on the basis of the response to the actual question. You say that when the circumstances so allow, and you said it twice, I'm trying to understand whether my understanding of the bill is correct. What happens the day after the bill becomes of force and effect? Can I the day after go to an advocate and brief him? And can you accept my brief just as a member of the public? And if not, what needs to happen for that to happen in specific terms, and who decides it? Because if we are just in the creating an enabling provision, as it may seem to be the case, to give the power to the Bar Council to enable that to happen, with all due respect, Mr. Chairman, it's like asking a dog to wear a muzzle of its own accord. It's not going to happen.
Mr. Scosana. Oh, sorry, Mr. Dyer.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the aspect that we engaging in is terribly important for all the right reasons. I agree 100% with Ms. Schaefer that it should be impossible and illegal to take monies from the public without cover by way of fidelity fund certificate. I don't think there's anybody around this table that's going to disagree with that proviso. The instances in which advocates ought to be allowed to deal directly with the public needs to be debated. What are those instances? And from the general feeling discussing matters with advocates, in the current regime where you have the majority of advocates, the so-called non-GCB advocates, who are referred to as label advocates sometimes, are in excess of members of the GCB. And I think there's also a myth about that, Chairperson. There's a perception that the majority of advocates belong to the GCB. In fact, Chairperson, it's the other way around. No. The majority of non-GCB advocates exceed members of the GCB. So in the country we have about 6,000 advocates, the majority of whom don't belong to the GCB. So the point that I make, in the current regime, those advocates that operate outside the GCB have to go, like the members of the GCB, through an instructing attorney. But there's been concerns that those advocates actually accept monies directly. There are instances where they are accepting monies directly. I think when it comes to the issue of the regulations, there has to be a debate as to what are the instances that allow direct briefing, because with that comes the concomitant responsibility to have been trained in trust law practice, which attorneys are trained. So as part of your LLB degree, you, at some stage, you're going to have to make an election what you want to do. Do you want to be a referral practitioner? Do you want to be an attorney? And if you decide to go the attorney route, you're going to have to take those courses that's going to gear you to understand trust account, because your obligations to the Fidelity Fund are severe. So I suspect when the debate comes up and when somebody decides it is time that advocates also are allowed to take monies directly from the public, these are the issues that are going to be debated and decided as to whether it is feasible and proper to go directly to the advocate. So Mr. Tosiana is quite correct. And I hear the concern of Mr. Rossini insofar as what happens if the bill is accepted today, can tomorrow the possibility of briefing an advocate kick in automatically? The answer is no, because the provision says the regulations will deal with it in a consultative process where the minister has to draft regulations in consultation with council. And at that stage, I think these issues will be debated in detail. But I suspect that if you leave it out now and don't create the enabling environment, you're going to have to tweak the bill later on. Okay. So that would be my take, Chair.
Mr. Holomisa, the word enabling is the one that I wanted to hear.
Can you say, well, what is the current practice now? You mentioned that it seems to be advocate belonging not to the GCB who take money from the public. What happens in that regard? How is that dealt with by the profession?
Sure, the independent association of advocates also has a mechanism similar to the GCB in which they have disciplinary committees. And so they deal with instances of that violation where you take direct money from the public in terms of their disciplinary regime. The criticism by the General Counsel of the Bar is that it is not done effectively, that lots of members are falling through the cracks. And of course, the ideal situation for the General Counsel of the Bar would be that all admitted advocates are part of one regulatory regime. And ideally, they would want all independent advocates to be part of the GCB. But there's comparative reasons why people are not part of the GCB, ranging from the cost of bar fees, the issue of being able to afford premises, and perhaps there's concerns about the training and the various rules that exist within that fraternity, rightly or wrongly. I'm not making comment on that.
Besides, it goes against the principle of voluntary association, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the relevant sub-clause 9. The minister may, after consultation with council and board, prescribe the framework for the creation and recognition of limited liability legal practices and the terms and conditions applicable.
Study 4, subsection 2.
The advocate may render legal services in expectation of a fee, permission, gain, reward determined in accordance with the Act upon receipt of brief, upon receipt of request of their agent, provided such request complies with any regulation made after consultation.
Mr. Alamisa, please pull the mic closer to you, Mr. Alamisa. Otherwise, we can't hear what you're saying, and it's a conversation between yourself and Mr. Dyer.
Because I wanted to find the answer from him. thanks. No, I'm trying to determine whether we're not being lazy in postponing this determination of under what circumstances advocates can take cases directly from members of the public. But my understanding would be that it is clear from this act, it would be clear from this act, the conditions under which attorneys should practice and even deal with money from the public. Now, if we don't do that with respect to advocates and we want them to be able to be accessible directly to members of the public, then that should be made clear from the very beginning. That's why I was keen to find out if the independent Association of Advocates of South Africa has any clear regulations regarding this issue. Because my understanding of the need for you to be a member of the Bar Council, it had to do with, first of all, you have to write a bar admission exam. And if you are to be a member of the other association, you don't have to write the bar admin exam. Which means then that also the other reason, the other advantage for advocates was that if you belong to the Bar Council, then you are able to be protected as a member against the instances where an attorney would brief another advocate without having paid you your fees. There's that kind of protection mechanism to blacklist advocates. I mean, attorneys firms that do not pay the fees and then go to another. So the membership of the bar council, I don't think really has that much to do with this question of accessibility of the advocates to members of the public. So my view here is that let the department and everybody else concerned try and find a way of making it clear from the act itself and not postponing for regulations to determine how an advocate in this instance would be allowed to be accessible to the public.
Okay. All right, you've got that. Ms. Pilana Majake, followed by Mr. Ambrosini.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to go back to the principle that was being discussed in terms of the minister having the power to make regulations in consultation with the council, and that all regulations must be approved by Parliament. And then you further indicated that Parliament will actually only have to look at fundamental regulations, technical ones, maybe. Done outside Parliament, but my worry is how are you going to determine technical from fundamental? So that there isn't any confusion or finding that there are regulations that do not come for approval by Parliament, and they are actually then labelled technical, and maybe we do not come to agree at some point. The regulation is either technical or fundamental. So for now, what I hear is that you then gave an example on what you could regard as a fundamental regulation in terms of clause 3.2. Now we're focusing on that example, but I want us to go back to the basic principle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a member of the opposition, and my job description is that of highlighting shortcomings and putting forward their criticism. But just last night I was thinking how extraordinary this country has been under the ANC leadership at the from the legislative viewpoint. And that has to be said. In the past 19 years, this parliament has adopted the most extraordinary reforms. They sent medical doctors in rural areas to help people before they can qualify. It's changed everything. It brought the country from what was a very backward country, one of the most progressive countries in the world. And it's done it with courage, with determination, with thinking that people will accept. Now, I have a problem with the answer given, because here we say, in this committee, well, we're looking at the issue, but we're kicking to the minister. After consultation with the advocates, we'll decide whether or not the advocates need to be transformed into an evolutive process. I mean, I think it is our responsibility here for the same courage of reshaping this profession as we had, as the parliament has had the courage of reshaping anything else. And it's done quite well. The problem that not at least from the opposition benches, we identify more often than not is with implementation of laws rather than the actual laws, with the exception of the economic affairs. But I think we need to grapple with this issue because it affects the people and decide what the outcome is. And if the outcome is one way or the other, we should have the courage of willing the outcome without leaving it to the minister to decide in consultation with those who are very affected by the outcome.
Right.
Yes, I might just say, and we can certainly now get onto some sidetrack, but Dr. Lambrosini's interpretation of the role of an opposition MP is very modest and confined. Mm-hmm. I've been here a very long time, and I legislate just like any other legislator. I do not see my role as pointing out the shortcomings from government ministries and departments. We all legislate together. So I think what I understand what you're saying. You're saying we must cut through everything, change the legal system, change how it works. But this bill is different. It's one of a kind. And I think that there is very great wisdom, as I said yesterday, in taking an evolutionary approach. I don't think that applies throughout. I think that we should do something active about relaxing the referral rule. And it is going to be a very, very unpopular step with advocates. But I do think that there is merit in doing it. It's 1999 that Judge Cameron said, why don't you start working on it? And that is to me an instance where legislators have a duty to cut through and establish now a new way of working. But as for most of the other issues, I think there's enormous wisdom in the evolutionary and incremental route. I have some real difficulties with creating simply a council taking away the rights of volunteers. But those are a different kind of thing. But so I think we understand, Mario, what you're saying. You're saying cut through all of this, do the deed, because it's been 14 years. I think we can do that in some respects, not in all of them.
Mr. Dyer, and then Lizelle Adams.
Chair, I just want to make the point that in this bill before us, there is no provision to take away the right to associate voluntarily. It doesn't exist. It will never exist. It's a fundamental right in the Constitution. This bill does not say you will cease to exist. So you can have the GCB, the LSSA, the pension lawyers, Christian lawyers, whatever lawyers, whatever advocates, they will exist, they will continue to exist. BLA, Nadel, Advocates for Transformation, the whole shebang, they continue to exist because they must. They serve a purpose, they have a specific focus, a member interest, and rightly so. This bill is to create a regulatory regime for admitted attorneys and advocates. Thank you.
Ms. Adams?
Adams.
With regards to clause 34.2b, I just want to know, is it definite that there will be regulations, and does the department now know already what those regulations will possibly entail? Because it's written here, provided that such request complies with any regulation that the minister may make after consultation with the council, so it seems like the minister may decide to make it or not. Or to draft those regulations or not.
All right.
There are no regulations in place, and there are not even any thoughts on what those rules should be. It's a matter which, from our own thoughts, will be initiated by the council and the profession. Hence, it's not must, it's may. When we have reached that stage and when it becomes clear it's one of the fundamental transformation that is necessary for this country. And linking the issue of regulations to what Honourable just said, there are regulations which may be made, which obviously will be which must be made. And there are regulations which, and all regulations are after consultation based on the approval by Parliament. What I said earlier on is that we can take it upon ourselves to unpack all the regulations that have to be made here in the entire bill and come back to the to this committee and say, this one may be technical because Parliament may not be the interest of Parliament to be involved in the minute details. This one may be fundamental. So we'll take them from the bill and unpack them for the committee. The next one is one of the most talked about subject, the fee structure. And we thought we wanted to clarify a few things which happened during the submission. One, I know that many submissions and the media kept saying that it is wrong for the minister to cap fees. There were two, and I think there were two things which were confused. When the minister addressed the legal profession when at this parliament last year during the ballot vote speech and the subsequent briefing of the profession, the minister was referring to fees that are paid by state in refer to matters where the state has interest, and the minister as the member of as the lead litigator state attorney, I think he, in terms of the current state attorney's act, he has the authority to set the parameters of what government as a party pays, and there's nothing in our view untoward if the minister say this is the amount you can pay and SC this is the amount you can pay a junior council, whatever, and we can cap up this level, etc. So the capping by the minister was only the context of those services for which the state have an interest. The capping intended in terms of this act was basically the fees that can be paid by any other person in terms of services they receive from the lawyers. Now, one, I think there's a mixed bag of views. I think the BLA and the GCP are of the view that leave the fee, they must be determined by the market itself.
By the market?
Yes. The BLA says so. The BLA says leave it can be determined by the market.
Is it presently determined by the market?
Yes.
No. That's my question must be answered. Are the fees now, presently, right as we speak now, determined by the market? Any one of you can answer. By the market?
Yes.
The advocates' fees are determined by the market. Even the state attorney's fees
unless that has changed dramatically, state attorney, when they instruct an advocate, the advocate goes according to market. He charges the market fee.
Yes.
The attorney's fees,
yes,
are on a party-on-party basis. If you win a case, that is capped in terms of the Attorney's Act. That is most different. And your conveyancing attorney's fee is also capped. Your attorney's fee is recommended fee. So there are more
fees.
Yeah, it's tariffs. It's tariffs. The conveyancing.
Yes.
Well, it's set, and I suppose you can negotiate down. But your tax costs are according to the tariff. That's your litigation tariffs. Okay. So there is more regulation. There's more fixed fees for attorneys than advocates. That's basically. Advocates seem to be according to market. They did have guidelines that they issued. That was then opposed by the Competitions Act. Competitions Authority said you may not issue guidelines. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, this is only partially true, if I may interject. It is correct, but what that doesn't take into account is that market dynamics are very highly altered by anti-competitive arrangements. In the Trading Industry Committee, when the Competition Commission was still under Trading Industry Commission, we asked them to look into that. And the matter is still being considered, so we need to have also a sense of the impact of this bill, of that ongoing investigation. For instance, once an advocate has issued a bill, he cannot cap the bill, he cannot reduce the bill without the consent of the bar. It's an internal rule, highly anti-competitive. So even though you don't have guidelines, there is a general understanding, typical of a cartel, that one doesn't cut rules without the approval, one doesn't cut fees without the approval of the colleagues. If you did that in any other field, you would find yourself in a hell of a trouble. They get away with it. So we need to look at the impact of the bill on existing anti-competitive practice. And the most anti-competitive practice of them all is that the guy who pays the fees doesn't have the power to negotiate them. Because you hire the lawyer, the attorney, and the attorney hires the advocates. And yes, the attorney tells that he will try to negotiate the fee, but it doesn't happen. You don't have the arm-length transaction between the guy who charges and the guy who pays. There is this intermediary guy, typical of a medieval guild, which makes sure that the other guy doesn't need to be in a market environment negotiating his fees.
Mrs. Schaefer, before you, Mr. Dyer and Mr. Scorsone. No, you go ahead.
No, I mean, just on Mr. Scorsone's point about the misunderstanding, there's no misunderstanding. We understand that the Minister was speaking about that last year, but what I refer to is regulations under 9241I, where it says the Minister may make regulations regarding to the fee structure of legal practitioners. Now, I mean, that could well include capping of fees. So it's not a misunderstanding at all.
Yes, but he may. Well, yes. And these are regulations that come to us after consultation with the council. All right, fine, we'll look at that. Mr. Scorsone.
Chair, the comments are extremely helpful for the department. And for that reason, the issue of the fees can be highlighted as one of those key aspects that will be controversial in the way in which it is handled. I agree what Mrs. Smuts, practicing attorney, is saying. You have fees that are laid down in the tariffs in terms of where matters go to court, and they are governed by a strict fee arrangement in terms of tax costs. You also have what is called attorney and client fees. Mm-hmm. Everyone is aware of the mayhem and chaos in third-party personal injury matters.
and we must not be oblivious to the current practice. We read the newspapers. How do we responsibly deal with that? How do we protect the public from those practitioners that see it as their right to earn fee arrangements in ludicrous amounts? So, are we all around going to be saying it's fine, we mustn't deal with a malaise? What do we do? And there has to be a responsible approach to the citizens of this country. Why are our fees similar to New York prices? We're a developing democracy. So at the one hand, your right to trade, your right to make as much money as you want to, like anybody else, has to be weighed in as against your right not to be irresponsible when you are charging. And how do you deal with that? That's the tough question. How do you deal with that? Is tapping the way to go? We don't know. But there has to be a mechanism in which this issue has to be debated. And the options which Mr. Skosana will deal with in terms of how we propose we could deal with it will be spoken to. But also let's turn to the issue of the existing practice of junior-junior, senior-junior, middle-junior, senior counsel, senior-junior. All of these practices, super-senior. Let's look at all of that in the context of what the reality is. When you are pitched in a certain bracket, there's an understanding. That's your fee. Now, the member of the public doesn't understand this, has no say about it, and they go to the instructing attorney, I want a competent advocate, and this is what needs to be paid. So, that existing arrangement that doesn't exist in any book because it's been ruled by the Competition Commission has been anti-competitive, and rightly so. The question we ask ourselves, chairperson, has a practice died a death? The answer we all know, it hasn't. The issue of the ranking of seniority, which equals what you will earn. So you could get somebody that has had extensive knowledge and practice as an attorney who enters the advocate's profession. So he's a baby junior.
Baby junior.
That's all I want to say, Chair.
All right. In the bill itself, either you, Mr. Dyer, or Mr. Bassett, or Mr. Sassana, other than Clause 94I, where else does the bill deal with fees?
It's clause 35.
35.
The entire clause. And the
okay.
Yes. The legal practitioner, juristic entity, or legal aid service may only charge fees in respect of legal services as are in accordance with the fee structure determined in terms of this act, taking into account the importance, significance, complexity, and expertise of legal services required, the volume of work required, and the time spent in respect of the services rendered, and the financial implication of the matter at hand, or as may be determined by law.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Okay, I remember during the hearings asking somebody, I can't remember who, I assume it would have been the department, but it may have been the Bar Council or the Law Society. And that was for some kind of whether there's any report being done, a sort of snapshot of the legal profession, in private practice, 5 years ago and currently. So at the bar, the different the race, the gender, the years practicing of advocates 5 years ago or 10 years ago and currently, and then the same with attorneys. So one can get a sense of, I mean, obviously this law is going to be having a significant impact, but we've got a sense of is the profession able to grow are advocates, particularly entry-level advocates, able to make a living? Entry-level attorneys, how many are on their own? How many are being absorbed by the big firms? What is happening to the small firms of attorneys? But basically, what's happening to the profession? Because I think we need to know that, and then we would have an idea of how to influence it with the bill. And that links, I'm raising it now, Chair, because I think it links to the whole issue of fees. I think the argument that gets raised, particularly by the advocates, is if they can't charge the fees that they want to, then they're not going to be able to survive. But with these exorbitant fees, how many are actually surviving? Because it's maybe the senior counsel that charge the exorbitant fees, and the
baby juniors
have to make do with peanuts.
Are you asking the department to Mr. Jeffrey?
Sorry?
Are you asking the
department? I said I can't remember who I asked in the thing, but I think the department would be the appropriate body. If they want to source it from the Bar Council, if they've got any research, or the Law Society, then they should do that. The issue on the Smuts's point, I mean, I think you invariably don't have, I mean, you don't have advocates in smaller towns apart from Grahamstown. They follow a high court. Okay. So it's basically the advocates would be limited to places where there's a seat at the High Court. Even with a circuit court, I mean, I know in KZN Ladysmith there's a Ladysmith Circuit Court, but I don't think you've got any advocates there. I think they all come up from Durban or Pietermaritzburg. But I think it's that point of view.
Talking about
okay, one small town.
The big cases are in the big courts. And on the subject, I was really talking about one of the worst attorney's firms in Johannesburg.
Please put your mic on, Dean.
One of the great attorneys firms in Johannesburg in their submission accept the scheme in Clause 35. They're generally supportive, but they want some factors added, and one of those factors is location. Now, if you're familiar with those big buildings, the attorneys at the Sandton building, they want location added. Location, and location. They want the experience of the lawyer, the location, and the overhead costs. I just thought this was very, very striking. I mean, if you see those firms, I'm sure you all have. Location.
Let me, hang on, just give me a second here. I've seen Mr. Swart. I've seen Pilani Majake. And I've seen Mrs. Schaefer, and then Mr. Amrosini. In that order, please, Mr. Swart.
I'm just ascertaining the provision relating to the fee structure as it regards the attorneys. If I look at the back, laws to be repealed, there's nothing about repealing the Superior Court Act. You know, remember the Supreme Court Act used to determine the tariffs for attorneys in litigation, and the Magistrates Court rules determines that tariff. Will that continue, or will there now be new rules that will determine that aspect? I just need to get an understanding, because I see these provisions for rules here as well. So I just need to understand where the attorney's tariffs for litigation will be inserted. Because I see at the bottom your fee structure 35.1A, as determined by this act at the bottom, may be determined in law. So that then presupposes those other acts and rules will continue operating.
Chair, could I answer that?
All right.
Chair, I'm also the secretary to the Rules Board for Courts of Law. So, in response to the question, the Rules Board will continue to make rules and set those tariffs for all litigious matters that go before court. So all new party and party scales, all of those costs that are contained in the current format in terms of the bills will be retained. That won't fall away, because those are taxed party and party costs in terms of specific scales that currently exist and will continue to exist. What we have is what is referred to as attorney and client fees, where parties contract above what the prescribed fee is and are allowed to charge their clients consultation fees and a whole range of other things. They rightly can charge for and enter into agreements with their clients, even with regard to their hourly rate and whatever the case might be. So those will continue to exist. And interestingly enough, what the Rules Board is considering is also a detail for advocates. which currently doesn't exist. Fee tariffs for advocates. For advocates that will be contained in the current rules, because what you've got to a large extent is attorney's fees. And so the Rules Board has received requests to consider tariffs for advocates, and we're currently considering that.
Just
a little follow up on that, because it's also important, because when you tax a bill, the advocates' fees are also taxed. So you can argue as an opposing party that the advocates' fees are too high and get a reduction. The taxi master, and we've got that recent constitutional court case that says the council's fees are too high. So there is a mechanism to reduce advocates' fees, but that doesn't your client still have to pay the increased amount, even if I understand that correct. Let's just get that right. If you lose a case and you are taxed, if it's reduced, the advocate loses. What happens to that where the tax master reduces the fee on taxation? The advocate loses out, surely, because he can't recover it. You have to pay the costs as the losing party. You have your costs taxed. You have to pay the attorney's costs and the advocate's costs. The taxi master says the advocate's costs are too high. It's reduced, say, by half. You then don't have to pay the balance. You only pay half of that. What happens? Does the advocate just write off the balance?
He charges
his own client then.
He charges the client, yes. In all this, the client is out of the picture. Yeah, that's where the problem lies. Ms. Pilani Majake.
Thanks, Chair. The point I wanted to make, and that goes to the comment that was made about the market determining the fees, which was I think it was a submission, I just want some clarity. It was the BNA submission, which actually contradicts the intention of the DA, because we actually are intending to come up with a system that has got fees that are affordable, but if you're going to leave the market, it will become difficult. It will leave us with the same situation. That's from my interpretation of what was said. And then Honorable Jeffries has actually requested you to go and make some kind of an investigation as to how much the baby advocates are getting in terms of survival and things like that, which I think in terms of the discussion we had around fusion and merger of the judiciary yesterday, we need to actually also get information in terms of the types of qualifications, the number of years spent at university, and also the experience that one has got, so that we can then manage to take that into consideration when we actually want to make the two conclusions.
Sure, I just want to confirm that the department will source all the information. It is in a position to do so, and we will furnish it to the committee.
All right. Whilst you're at it, at the same time, also access those court judgments. I think it's the Concord. Of course, Camps Bay, yes. And the Road Accident Fund. Where courts made those statements or as part of their judgments on the exorbitant fees. I don't know if we want them to access for us. He wasn't a judge at the time. Owen Rogers' article. Okay. Well, we'll get it from the Smuts then. Okay. What about? No, wait. You can come back a second round. All right. Not a bad idea. Mrs. Schaefer.
Thanks. My colleague kind of joked about the overhead issue, and I understand why when I saw what firm it was, but the fact of the matter is that we do need to take that into account in reality, that there are overhead costs in running a practice. And if you want a professional service, you need to pay a certain amount to maintain that service and for people to be able to afford the updated legal documents and cases and all that kind of thing. So it's not so totally a ridiculous suggestion. But my real question is this: why is it okay to put an upper limit, and that's okay, that's not anti-competitive, when you can't put a tariff? And why is it okay to have tax tariffs but not other tariffs for attorneys? What's the difference? I mean, you're saying the tariff structure is going to stay as it is for tax costs. But I mean, as far as I understand, that's what the Competition Commission is not happy with. Now, why are they happy that you can limit a person's upper limits for income, but not the lower limits? I mean, to me, that's equally anti-competitive for attorneys. If it is clients who are prepared to pay more, why shouldn't they? So I don't quite understand. It seems to me a bit of a contradiction. We can have tariffs for tax costs, but you can't have tariffs for general legal fees. You can cap limits to an upper limit, but you can't have a lower limit. What is the difference? If someone can explain to me, I might understand.
Let's hear Mr. Ambrosini first, Mr. Dyer, and then you can respond to both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, tariffs, I had the benefit of practicing the tariff environment in Italy and a non-tariff environment in the States. In a tariff environment in Italy, they have tariffs for each activity, and this is one criterion, and the other criterion is the value of the subject matter. So if you are writing an affidavit in a case which is worth 1,000 rand, is going to be 10 rands. The same affidavit in a case worth 100 million rands is going to be 1 million rands. And you need to adjust for the, in terms of the value of the matter, and then there are necessary escape clauses on the complexity of the matters. And these things end up being complex as well. And what has been, even in a tariff environment, you end up with the same disparities between the prestigious name recognized lawyer and the new lawyer, doing exactly the same job for exactly the same things, but the one ends up charging more, and the tariffs can be manipulated. Sure, it is a constraint, it is a partial solution, but I warn against the fact of that being the solution. What we really need to do is to eliminate the root cause, which creates the perception that some people are incredibly better than others. And it's in a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we cast certain people with an aura of invincibility, that projects onto the judges, and there is great name recognition, the big senior counsels, the big five, the big ten, whatever they may be. And we as a government contribute to that. I mean, we all know that there aren't really super lawyers. Yes, there are a few lawyers who are much better than others, but at the end, law is what it is. It's not a matter of the acrobats or painters or arts. It's linear. So some cases can be put better than others, but it doesn't justify for one lawyer doing the same job being paid 100 times, if not 1,000 times more than the other guy making the same thing. What we need to be concerned is to bring back market dynamics to market dynamics, not to alter those market dynamics, and let the market, not the government, decide who is the good lawyer and who is the bad lawyer. And then things will regulate themselves. That's one aspect. The other aspect, that in reaction to what John was saying, which I think is very relevant, I'm trying to go through the submission. I didn't find real inputs in that sense. Where is the profession going? We have transformed the legal system by making it extremely more complex. So the South African law profession is required to do a jump within a few years, which has been the product of evolution in other countries over 50 years. And that is abandoning the single practitioner for the very simple fact that there is no subject matter now which can be dealt with in complete isolation from all of the other subject matter. Even family law is no longer insular. And you don't know, no one has the capabilities and the expertise of knowing the entire subject matter. And those who live amongst advocates, you see how each advocate consults with the other advocates, consults with the other advocates, even in an environment in which technically you are hiring one single advocate to do a job, because it is no longer possible to expect everyone to be competent about everyone else. What does that mean? It means that the future in this country as in other countries lies by necessity into specialization and therefore in larger firms. Single practitioners, whether it's a single attorney or a single advocate, is no longer viable from a competency viewpoint. And it's a disservice to the consumers. So I submit to you, Mr. Chairman, that we as legislators should encourage the profession to be transformed into that direction. And there are lots of vested interests, especially in terms of seniority. The type of transformation, as the abolition of senior counsels, will enable younger people to upset existing hierarchies and getting on top. And I, for one, think that that's good.
Mr. Jeffrey. Yeah, sorry, Paul. I hope to now be able to be in the meeting till the end. So sorry if I've missed things. But I think if we're still dealing with the issue of fees and tariffs, the issue of the medical profession, they have tariffs set. Okay, they can charge more.
Okay.
But there are tariffs. Okay, they're more medical aid tariffs, I think. But has the department looked at is there anything to be learnt from the medical profession? And then particularly with the whole issue of uncompetitiveness. Then a general point. You know, Chair, as you remember when we went to Germany, the Germans were quite aghast at the cost of, well, when most of us went to Germany, the Germans were quite aghast at the cost that the fees that lawyers were charging. It is a different legal system. It's a inquisitorial system, so maybe the lawyers have to do less than in our accusatorial system. But I'm interested in what's happening in other countries, and I think particularly Commonwealth countries because we seem to have this sort of dual bar, sidebar, main bar, attorneys, advocate system from the British. I'd heard, as I think I mentioned yesterday, that Zimbabwe has abolished the double bar. How is it working there? What is the issue? Well, there's a lot we can learn from Zimbabwe. I mean, the education is good. But I think particularly India I'm interested in, because that's a developing country.
Former colony.
So similar traditions from the legal system. And this one is aimed, I think, more, Chair, at the researchers. It would be useful looking at some comparative, our researchers, committee researchers, but the department could input as well if they want to. I don't know if they've looked at it. But where is legal reform going in developing countries that were former colonies? And as I said, particularly India. I mean, you know, Australia, Canada are developed, so there may be things we can look at, but there may not be, but developing countries particularly. Nigeria, I suppose, but India particularly.
All right.
Shaper's saying she'd like to go on a study trip to Zimbabwe, but maybe we can just send her and the rest of us will.
India. She'd need a.
Or we don't have to go anywhere. We can just send her because she missed out on Germany.
She'd need the four bodyguards.
Yeah.
The Smiths.
On the fact of the affordability cost, Mr. Dyer has quite closely studied the developments in the UK, I'm told, and I wonder whether he shouldn't be given a little time to fill us in on what's happening there. But my question to him now is, what happened to the fees in the UK? I've only just started reading the triennial reviews, and they are July last year, right? But what happened to the fee issue? In fact, the latest reforms in the UK came from the Office for Trade, didn't they? They were precisely consumer-driven, client-driven.
All right. Mr. Dyer, Mr. Scosana, Mr. Bassett.
Chair, I do undertake to provide the committee with a snapshot of what are the current trends in developed and developing regimes. So we will do that. Because of time constraints, I think it might be unfair to go into that entire discussion today. So we'll get that information, we'll pass it through. What I would like to talk about very briefly is maybe the confusion about tariffs and the issue of anti-competitiveness and minimums and maximums, just very, very quickly. What we've got in our current rules, if you sue somebody by way of an action or if you bring an application, there are distinct tariffs that you would be able to charge as an attorney and an advocate in order to take a matter to a trial stage. So, for example, if you peruse a document, it's a certain amount per 100 words, a folio. And if you prepare a document, there's a tariff that is allocated to preparing the particular tariff. If you attend a consultation, there's a fee, if the candidate's attorney is there, if counsel is there. There are tariffs that would be awarded when the matter is finalized, an order is made, and those are what are commonly called taxed costs that the one party can retrieve from the other.
Mm-hmm.
So where this has developed is so that the public are fully aware of what the fees are, the attorneys and advocates are aware what they can charge, and the Rules Board has over the years, from representations received, increased those tariffs to bring it realistically in line with what is fair and reasonable. Of course, the legal profession will say that the fee is unreasonable and they must be upped all the time. It's an ongoing process and it's not a fundamental science that we've perfected and what is fair, reasonable is decided by the committee at the Rules Board and those are sent to all and sundry to comment on. But here's the problem that currently exists. There's a whole range of matters that are non-litigious. So take labor matters, take criminal matters, take drafting all your company documents. Those are all non-litigious matters. And there's a whole range of matters that don't fall into the basket of litigious matters. So there are no guidelines that currently exist because, as we know, the Competition Commission said the profession has even drafted guidelines for non-litigious matters. And we believe there's no place for that because it's anti-competitive. So that has been taken away. There is nothing preventing a client from entering into an arrangement with an attorney and an advocate to pay that legal professional a fee above the taxed fee arrangement. And that's the attorney and client fee. It's a practice that exists. And it is dictated by the agreement that you enter into with your instructing attorney. And that you are not going to be able to stop. But the question is, should we set minimum tariffs? Well, to a certain extent, there are tariffs that currently exist in the fee guidelines in terms of your rules of courts that says, well, if you draft and if you do this, that's the fee. And of course, nothing stops you from charging below that. The big problem is, how do you set tariffs that may have a maximum impact? And how do you come to such a decision in the public interest? And that debate is something that will fall into the realm of the Fees Committee or the Rules Board or when the regulations about fees are going to be discussed. And I really do not have an answer as to how we are going to solve that problem. And I think it's something that the committee will have to deal with in terms of where it accepts the options.
I don't understand why it's okay to have a tariff for litigious matters, but it's not okay to have a guideline for non-litigious matters. It's the same thing.
It's been declared. Guidelines have been declared anti-competitive. They say you can charge whatever you want to charge, and if you want to charge a minimum fee, that's up to you. You mustn't dictate what people can charge.
Mr. Ambrosini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to speak about what I want to speak about. I'm just asking for your guidance as per when I want to. You will allow me to speak about it. I hope that my colleagues will not react to what I'm going to say without giving me an opportunity of saying it. This deal stops without completing the job in respect of two aspects. And I would like an opportunity to inquire from colleagues whether or not we are satisfied that those two aspects are not going to be covered and remain within the rules of the rule boards. I think they shouldn't. First of all, is the reform of the judicial process. All this discussion about fees is a function of a non-functional, dysfunctional, obsolete judicial process. Don't look at me in the tone of voice. we're not doing it with this deal. We could do it by the actual law, and we made a discussion in this committee on the reading of the Constitution of whether, in fact, the Constitution creates a reservation of rules as far as the judicial process is concerned, and I understand that John was of the opinion that it doesn't, and I tend to agree with him. I don't want to discuss it now, just give you a note. And the other one is the issue of fees fall in succumbency, whether or not the party which loses should pay the other party's cost. I would like to be able to approach you on these two issues, Mr. Chairman, when you decide that is the right time. I don't want to disrupt proceedings, but it flows from this issue.
All right, not today.
Don't respond to what Ivan said.
Not today. All right, wait. We'll have a chance to have that discussion. Mr. Skosana.
The fact that there have been so various views expressed on this matter confirms the need to further reflect on this matter. When we discussed with the department, as a department in response to the views here, obviously, we thought that the committee may want to consider, not necessarily as a way of postponing this issue, but as a way of basically rationalizing all these aspects that leads to fees, in the light of what Mr. Jeff has said, also of having seen some investigations, whatever. This committee will realize that in the Supreme Court's bill, we did maintain within the Supreme Court's bill maintain the current rulemaking processes, and we did allude that there's a process that needs to unfold to rationalize those aspects. Et cetera. I'm sure if the Rules Board Act was going to be initiated a bill today as is, it will not be passed. Because there will still be many objections. That is an fact, because those rules are made and approved by the minister, initiated by the rules board, and the process of participation, whatever, all those as a film need to be looked at, etc. What we had proposed, therefore, was that we can basically suggest your committee that Section 35, and Section 94 was basically going to, was written on Section 34. Ms. Schaefer, basically the regulations that are contemplated in 34 would have arisen from 35. So there's a correlation. 35 makes determine a fee structure, and then 94 sets up the power of your minister to do execute it. So they're not different. We have thought that the better option could be basically to make it very explicit that legal practitioners may charge fees, as may be determined in accordance with national legislation. So that then the whole process of setting up the structure, setting up the fees, structure, is not an element of this bill, but it's an element of an act that will deal with all the fees arrangement that can do across all those aspects. So that is very clear. And I'm saying that again, not the sake of postponing these issues, because there are fees which are being prescribed through the rules board mechanism currently now, which are being looked at as part of the broader civil justice review. I know that the rules board are trying to organize a court in Durban to discuss the very same aspects that have been raised in terms of contingency fees, road accident funds, etc. And that will unfold and evolve in that process. There are discussions, there are aspects that are raised by the Competition Commission that the rules board itself, if it was going to determine fees, it must be looked in the context of the Consumer Protection Act and in respect of the Competition Act itself. Which be, because although currently the rules board determine those fees are only the practitioners who participate in that board, and the matters of fees remain a complex issue that is understood by attorneys themselves, not by consumers. Consumers, all they have to do, they have to pay what is being charged, and a rule will just be thrown before them and said, this is what has been determined by them. But they don't have much input into the process of even dealing with those fees or whatever. Although there are rules, but I know that when they draft those rules, they consult. But they consult the practitioners. They don't consult with my aunt in Michigan. They send a law site and GCP, etc. And the lawyer, themselves, the very first people who charge are the ones who come and say, this might improve, this fee is not much, the share is whatever, and does not allow that participation process whereby we can have a very scientific process of determining fees at the end of the day. So hence we say that if we take that approach, it will basically enjoin the department to initiate that legislation that will then include all the research that we referred to and come to this parliament that will then see how fees are going to be in terms of that act, what structures are going to be in place, what is wrong with the rules board, what are the guidelines, whatever, the Competition Commission arrangement, the Consumer Protection Act consideration. So we've got a dedicated focus bill act that deals with the other one, rather than mix it in terms of only Section 35, when the principles thereof are so diverse and involved than what we want to regulate here. And that may, in fact, even deal the issue of regulating this important subject through regulation at the end of the day by the minister. Thank you.
I mean, it sounds like it might be worth thinking about, but then what would happen in the meantime? Because then things would carry on as they are at the moment. And I mean, maybe that might be an idea to look at the composition of the rules board, perhaps, and see if maybe you can bring in more people, from the public. Yeah.
Because the other challenge with the rules board is it got practitioners and the judges who basically make the very same judgments in terms of the rules. And I know that the chairperson had to excuse herself on some of the judgment concord, because those rules have served before the rules board committee. We have looked into that aspect, that you can see how we can, as part of putting in interim mechanisms, empower the rules board to that body. But at least this act will then make a cross-reference to national legislation, which the rules board act, maybe that rule of any other act. Yeah. No, in the meantime, there's a mechanism in terms of the Transitional Council, which can find a negotiated settlement that continues in the Act of Parliament. I don't know if that can be left to them.
Just on a slightly different issue that was raised by, I think, Mr. Dyer, about the issue of the continuation of the voluntary associations, that is not being touched. Is that, as I understood you correctly? But obviously the big contentious issue is the transfer of all the assets and liabilities of those bodies to the council. That is the main complaint, and that's a major issue. And then I didn't quite understand, if you read Section 116, says the existing law societies and any voluntary association must continue to perform their powers until the commencement of Chapter 2. Does that not imply that they come to an end at the commencement of Chapter 2?
46?
116, page 53.
Okay.
So I think those are, I just want to highlight those issues when we're dealing with issues that need to be highlighted, that obviously it's 97.2, which is the assets, liabilities, staff, everything. Staff, everything is going to be transferred to the council. And that is a major shift, obviously, and there's a lot of objections to that by the various bodies. And then, of course, whether those voluntary associations continue. We'd have to relook at that wording of 116. So the two sections are 97.2, read with 116. Chair, I just wanted to highlight those two to be flagged.
Okay. Fair enough.
Madam Chair, we'll flag on those other aspects. The bill may basically not be fully reflective of what we had in mind. Obviously, we did indicate that as far as the assets and stuff, whatever, of the societies are concerned, we intended only to refer to those assets that are part of the law societies established under the Act, which would exclude voluntary associations. Therefore, there's no way that GCB staff, whatever, could then come and be part of this kind of arrangement. Then it will boil down to some form of expropriation, whatever, etc., because they are committed on. So that was what came out of our discussion. That only assets that relates to a law society established in terms of the Attorney's Act and this stuff, not law society of South Africa, which is a voluntary organization, and they put efforts and means to establish themselves. So they are not established in terms of the Act of Parliament. They are not a statutory body. Law societies are statutory bodies, which basically will the assets which have been acquired in terms of statute will then come into another statutory body. But any other association which is voluntary, you cannot touch that stuff whatever. Those can only be dealt on a negotiated basis if it's to enhance whatever. That's the thinking. In terms of the 1162, the thinking always has been that the reality is that currently there are voluntary associations that perform functions which are basically regulated in nature, which because they have not been regulated and it may happen that they have been taken care of by the voluntary association. It may be so that it's the GCB who initiate proceedings to remove a practitioner from practice. But it may be a function that forms within the broader context of regulatory function rather than the governance whatever function. Then to extend that may be the question. Hence, we said that we do not want to have a vacuum in the meantime. You cannot have Chapter 2 not enacted that puts those functions in the council. While you cannot have those functions being stopped by the GCB before the appropriate council comes into place. Although the consequences could mean that the GCB may not perform that function and may not exist. The intention that we conveyed here was only in relation to those functions which are regulatory in terms of this Act. So we are saying any regulatory function in terms of this Act which is performed by a voluntary association, and this is the first time that in a structure contemplated in section in the 2 of the bill has not come into place, they must continue to be performed by that association. But all I'm saying is that was the intention during the time. And I think we're going to reflect back on them in the light of the discussion that they don't result into unintended consequences of basically closing down the voluntary association at the end of the day. But that was the context in which those were discussed at the time.
Mr. Schaefer?
I mean, that's sounding more promising from what the original was, but in that instance, will that not affect your financial model then and what you took into account if the GCB was going to transfer their assets? And on that note, I really would like the department also, when you're coming up with these other requests we've had, to give us an indication of how things are currently funded, where the funding is coming from in each instance, and how much is necessary for
and what you envisage to be the cost implications of the proposed bill at the moment, because I think that's quite important.
Mr. Swart?
Yeah, just on that issue, as I understand it, the costs from the state are only going to be for the Transitional Council and then for the Office of the Ombud. The rest is all going to be borne by the profession themselves, but you obviously want that calculation.
Yeah. We're looking to that.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Chair. Let me now move to another matter, a fundamental issue, and that's the legal sales ombuds.
Mm-hmm.
I know that during the submissions and the hearing, they start from page, it's post 14, post 46, yeah. I think that from the submissions received, the principle of the ombuds is not strongly objected to. I think that just elements which have been raised. For example, who appoints, who must be the legal service ombuds, and the powers of the legal service ombuds. I think the GCB says the powers are too wide and checked and unclear. The LSSA, the gist of the LSSA submission is that the ombuds must be appointed by the Chief Justice. There's also suggestion that it must, the JSC must have a role in terms of that.
Also they will view that the battling lab provisions were clear up on this chart subject and currently. What we took away from them, that what we did not seem to agree with from the battling lab was that the JSC should have won them the judge,
and that judge must be appointed by the JSC, which then would have demanded the whole amendment of the Constitution, so that you provide the JSC with power. They don't have any power to appoint any other person other than a judge currently. So that we left out. Our initial bill had a retired judge, but it was the profession through our engagement that suggested that, look, it might be better to put in the bill a judge or a person who meet the requirement to be appointed a judge, because they felt that they may have among themselves in the profession practitioners who did not choose to join the bench, but who remain esteemed with integrity from the profession. So you are closing up, they came to us and tried to pay so that you are closing out from the profession. If you put the requirements that could even allow them to get appointed, that could do whatever. But I'm saying, I get the sense now, the strong view that, no, leave it to the retired judge. I don't think we've got any objection to the legal system boost to the judge, retired judge at the end of the day. From our side, as I'm saying, whether it was to be a judge, whatever, it was a matter that was raised at that instance, etc. So that's the first. And the other thing was that we have other legal system boots. We have other, the public protectors, whatever, who we are not judges per se like other countries, and who continue obviously to perform that work with much distinction. But as I'm saying, we are content with the position this committee may take. We don't have any strong view on that person not being a judge. What? No. I'm coming to your choice. Yes. Secondly, the bill says the president appoints the ombud. And we still support that view, that we see nothing wrong that the president appoints the ombud. It's not appointed by the minister, appointed by the president, and the ombud, makes recommendations to the minister over a variety of aspects, etc. The bartender bill said, which was a consensus bill at the time, said that in respect of this aspect, said that the ombuds must report both the minister and the parliament. I think that's the only distinction between these bills, because I think there's no explicit, although this interface is Parliament, but in terms of the reporting, the recommendations are direct to the minister. And you explained that this Parliament may want to take certain responsibilities from the ombudsman. I think that can be discussed, etc. We view that the president may appoint the ombuds, and we feel that we may build in extra measures just to make sure to put in place sufficient checks and balances, that power is not necessarily exercised in a manner that undermines the independence of the legacy ombuds. But in terms of other aspects of funding, whatever, etc., we agree that we'll put before this house a detailed funding model indicating what will be the cost of that office and what is the infrastructure, whatever. We've started that process, and I think the person from the chief financial officer who's leading the process was aimed to be part of this delegation to come and present it, but we thought we can have that opportunity in the next hearing. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Ambrosini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got four agenda items in these deliberations as my contributions. One, I discussed it yesterday about the advocates. The other two, I mentioned today, and I will address you when you give me the opportunity. And my fourth one relates to the specific issue. Then my nuisance level will be reduced substantially. I see the value of the ombudsman and the government-based approach to taking care of the consumers. What we are talking here about is taking care of consumers, the clients. Something goes wrong, somebody steps in on behalf of the clients. And the ombudsman is a mixture of government and profession taking care of what goes wrong. However, the most effective method, if we are serious about it, and it might not be alternative, it might be concurrent, is that of creating a strong and clearly defined delict of legal malpractice. In the United States, we are all terrified of being sued by an army of other lawyers out there who are dedicated to checking whether lawyers comply with ethical standards, because otherwise they get sued. And the first thing lawyers do is how we make sure we don't get sued. And they don't sue lawyers, they sue the insurance company behind the lawyers. It's a very lucrative environment. But that gives the immediate enforcement to the canons of professional responsibility. So the delict is constructed merely by making reference to the canon of professional responsibility, whether they are adopted by the profession or by the minister. And I think that is essential. That is not a statist government-based approach where the government protects the citizen. It is the option which I tend to prefer, where we arm the hand of the citizen. And that applies to the poor and to the rich, because behind the poor citizen, behind the guy who has got nothing, there will be a mean, hungry, and angry legal malpractice lawyer, which will be like an injury lawyer, who will find a way to make some money for himself by suing his colleagues for what has been done to the poor person. There is nothing more effective. If we want to be serious about consumer protection and client protection, I think that we should give consideration to that approach.
Okay. Ms. Adams.
Chairperson, with regards to clause 54, subclause 4, says the ombud holds office for the period determined by the president at the time of appointment. I think this is very vague.
Sorry, what clause, Ms. Adams?
50, subclause 4.
Oh, 50, subclause 4,
yes.
Right.
I think it's very vague because the president can even say until the person passes away, which might be forever. I think it must be consistent to, as in the case of the public protector, where it's for a specific period and not for reappointment afterwards again.
And if it becomes a retired judge, the person will be 70 or 75.
A
long as it's not until the person passes away. Clause 52, subclause 2.
50, subclause 2.
No,
52,
subclause 2. It says the ombud must appoint a director for a determined term. I think we also need to be specific on that. And then subclause 3, then the ombud may reappoint the director. My first question here is reappoint how many times? Because if it's once, then okay, that might be acceptable. But as long as it's not a reappointment and then a reappointment and then a reappointment afterwards again.
Okay. These are all changes we will make.
Or not.
Mr. Jeffries?
Yeah, I don't know if maybe it's been covered, but why is there so much concern around a limited term for the ombud? I mean, again, what is the sort of... if they're doing a good job, why do you want to limit it? The public protector, yes, has a limited term, can't be reappointed. Is this necessary for this? And the reappointment of the... You're agreeing that the director can be reappointed? Yeah, okay. But it's basically a question as to, why is it necessary to limit the term?
How do you think, because it's quite a very powerful position. Your judicial inspectorate is limited, your judge on interception is limited.
All right, it's something we need to debate and discuss, all right?
Because, there's limitations on people monitoring abuse of state power.
This is private.
All right. Mr. Swart?
No, I just wanted to ask whether the pensions on ombudsman is limited, but I don't think that's not a judge there. So I understand what the honorable judge is saying.
All right. Hang on, Mrs. Schaefer. Mr. Bilani Majake and then Mrs. Schaefer.
Thanks, Chair. I wanted to come in on the argument of whether to have as an ombudsman a judge or just anybody from the legal fraternity. I think it needs to be open. Because you need to have much impartiality, and that can actually also assist in that regard, rather than just leaving it to be handled just by people who are within the judiciary.
No, I'm just saying 48.2.
48.
It's not a judge. I mean, the salary is that of the judge.
Yes, but what Ilana Majake is proposing is that we should include. That it not be confined to just people from the legal profession, but should include judges as well.
But a judge would not have been admitted as an advocate or an attorney who's practiced for 10 years. Specialized knowledge of or experience for a cumulative period of at least 10 years in the administration of justice. Judges don't fit into that, I take it.
Mrs. Schaefer?
On that point, it would be useful to look at comparisons between pension and any other type of ombuds officers, just to see how they appoint, are there limitations on their terms and so on, if you could maybe give us that.
So is anybody wanting to propose a limitation on magistrates being ombuds or...
So you're influenced by the current situation. Okay, all right.
He was your friend.
All right. All right. Mr. Skosana, Mr. Volomisa first.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just sort of concerned by the idea that we might want not to appoint someone who has been a judge. If I'm correct, if I understand correctly the sentiment expressed that it shouldn't be a person who was a judge.
No, on the contrary.
No, I think what Ms. Pilane Majake was saying is it shouldn't just be confined to the attorneys and advocates profession, mm-hmm. but should include judge or retired judge.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Have I got it wrong, Ms.
Let me just repeat it to say that it shouldn't only be a judge, but should actually include other people within the legal fraternity. So it's
except magistrates.
I don't know whether we should take that. We need to think about it.
All right.
It's actually influenced by current feelings,
yes.
which may actually change with time.
Yes, current feelings.
Yes.
Yes.
Which may change with time.
I think it will take a long time for
Ms. Adams.
I think it should be a female judge from a rural area.
Oh God. Don't go there, please.
In a wheelchair.
I should actually rule you out of order. All right, Mr. Skosana, you've heard some of these comments. Some of them are in a bantering tone, so you can respond to those if you wish, but you're not obliged to.
Now I can continue. Just put on one issue, that of director. Director is basically the operational person of that board. And I think if the ombuds works perfect, the person whatever is 5 years whatever, that person can remain in the office. It's, we do not and it's in accordance with the other precedents in other similar bodies. We do not subscribe. We don't. Beyond the ombuds itself, beyond the functional, that will be perceived to be micromanaging the office at the end of this. But we will be guided by the committee. We don't have any strong views on these matters. Not that, yes. The next point, Chair, is a point which Mr. Swart raised yesterday and which I think we can just have another look onto it. The composition of the board, the Fuzzy Fund board, is clause 63. I think we wanted to, if you look, the board consists of five legal practitioners, consists of the following. Members, five legal practitioners nominated by the council, two nominated by the council but from the finance background, and two who are nominated by the minister. I think the principle, there are two principles which when we engage the profession, I think we found each other. One, I think the fund, Fuzzy Fund, exists for purpose of protecting the public. Not for the practitioners, and therefore the people who are aimed to be protected must have a say in that process and be part of that protection, whatever. Otherwise, it becomes a total the player and the referee. So there's no objectivity that could find opportunity to be expressed there. And secondly, that. There are certain expertise that we may not necessarily dispense with, and that is the people who possess the necessary financial expertise, actuarial experiences, whatever, that are very vital for the sustainability of the fund. Because we may not find all those people in the legal profession itself per se, or the people who are nominated may not come with expertise at the end of it. So the two categories that are brought in are those with a definite expertise from a financial perspective and actuarial background. Two is public interest, the very same people which are being protected by the fund at the end of the day. Other than that, the practitioners still have a bite in the board. What they have been raised from the submissions basically by, I think, the Law Society, if I'm not mistaken, is that they wanted a mechanism through which the attorneys can be nominated to a fund. That it must be an open, transparent public participation process. But we think that is a matter that can be regulated outside the Act itself and by the profession. From our side, I think if the Act states the numbers, whatever, they will find ways of finding those people to go into that process. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Skosana, who appoints the existing board? How is it appointed and who appoints it?
There isn't a board.
There isn't a board.
Okay. Chair? You're talking about the fund.
The current board of the Fidelity Fund,
yes,
is appointed by the LSSA recommendation, which is your BLA, Nadal, and statutory component.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unusual.
Recommendation to whom?
To the previous board of the fund.
Just slowly now, Mr. Dyer. Slowly. Slowly. You need to... So the present LSSA recommends to the existing board that when their term expires, the following people must serve on the board.
Correct.
Okay.
If the criticism currently is defined as incestuous, it's correct, and for that reason, the bill totally separates that problem that currently exists. Because on the one side, you've got the cap of the LSSA, you get onto a plane, you come to Cape Town, if you're from out of Cape Town, you put on the cap of the AFF. So the whole governance issue and separation and independence was questioned, and therefore in the current bill you will see explicit mention being made. If you're on the board, you cannot be on the council. If you're on the council, you can't be on the board. And rightly so.
Well, it says a lot for self-regulation, eh? All right, Mr. Jeffrey. Oh, sorry, Mr. Bassett, before we come in. Yes?
Chair, the provision of the Attorneys Act is Section 28, which says the board shall consist of the serving presidents of all societies and three members of each society elected annually by the council of the society. That's
all right. Mr. Jeffrey, what else?
Thanks. There has been, and I'm looking particularly at Ms. Smuts, who's busy caucusing. There's been some issues raised, and Ms. Smuts repeated them yesterday, relating to the ministerial appointments on the, what is it called, the council. Have there been similar concerns raised around ministerial appointments to the Fidelity Fund board? And why not, if they're so worried about the council? And then my worry is, you always look at if things can go wrong. And a member of the board, 69, must vacate his or her office if he or she has been convicted of any misconduct under this act or any offence which, in the opinion of the board, debars him or her from serving as a member of the board on account of incapacity and incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
If the person who nominated them wants them removed, and then the board must suspend a member after the commencement of proceedings by the board concerning the removal of that member. From the Fidelity Fund's presentation, there was a fair amount of controversy generated. Obviously, this is a better situation than we've currently got in terms of appointment. But is there not still a danger of if there's some problems by the profession, and somebody stands up against it, you know, what is there to protect them when it is the board itself that is going to be handling their removal? And how does one determine incapacity or incompetence? It's not specified in the bill.
Okay. Anyone else? Mr. Ambrosini?
Mr. Chairman, the legal profession varies over time. There are today ethical concerns which did not exist 10 years ago, and there will be ethical concerns which in the future which we cannot envisage now. That's why I think we need to set up a framework, incompetence, etc., and all these things very hard to assess, and we need to make an capable of just filling in the blanks. We need to have canons of ethical for the ethical profession which would apply to those who regulate the ethical profession as well, and the entire ethical profession gets permeated with them. I don't want to keep referring to the state, but just because I know in the state the NBA issues every year in a concerted process canons of professional responsibility which become more and more stringent every year, and they require to do work pro bono, they require and that applies to and they have canons for themselves as regulators of the profession, and it's perhaps the most stringent system known to me.
Alright. Anyone else, honorable members? No? Good. Alright. Well, that was a cheap round, Mr. Skosana. Next.
Okay. We have already dealt extensively with the next fundamental principle change, that is regulations and rules in terms of our broad approach. If under that's clause 94 and clause 95. Clause 94 is regulations, clause 95 is rules. Now, just prima facie from the look of it, you will see that we've got half a page on matters on which the minister may regulate. At the end of that page, any regulation made under subsection 1 must, before publishing thereof in the Gazette, be approved by Parliament. And that's what we've said, that surely if the commentators have just seen that part, they could have basically seen that it's still the Parliament have not basically delegated anything to the minister. The minister facilitates those regulations. They must not come here. But when you look at the next clause, it's those are the administrative and governance aspects that falls within the profession. Those are the rules which are not only on one page, but they overflow the other page. And all those aspects we believe that aspect of the GCB said they should leave the profession, and the bill leaves them to a profession. Manner in which application, enrollment is of practitioners has been dealt with, procedure of the council convening meetings, appointment of capacity staff, disciplinary bodies, how they get established, application for falsified certificates, the manner in which legal procedure may apply to convert registration, certificates form, manner of service of the subpoena, all those aspects. So and when you look at the rules, because they are basically operational in nature, all they have to do, the council must make sure that they publish the draft in the government gazette so that they can basically facilitate public comments from any person affected by those rules to add our views on the rules before they are being implemented. And the bill even goes further, that the council may even circumvent that requirement of publication provided certain measures are met, which are explained in 95.3 or so, if they've got good reasons why such rules need to be published without prior draft being published for people to make comments thereon, etc. And in terms of what you have said, on Chair, we still remain to be guided by this committee. As I've said, we will indicate those regulations which, in our view, that are technical and operational, and those which are fundamental, which then this committee may guide how they need to deal with them in terms of what you suggested, the inconcurrency, the deadlock breaking mechanism, and the after consultation subject to approval, and after consultation with the necessity of tabling, etc. The nature of the bill as is now, it will bring everything to Parliament in terms of the regulations because of the evolving nature of this process, etc. Thanks, Chair.
Right. Regulations first, Ms. Smuts, followed by Mrs. Schaefer.
May I just ask through you, Chair, JB, on the rules? See, I mean, you say now the self-voluntary organisations cannot and are not intended to be shut down. Those are the ones who have the right to do their own governance and management. But again, I mean, this really, it's not how the bill reads. It's certainly not how people read it. Because you say now that the council just publishes the draft in the Gazette. But if these bodies are self-governing and run their own management, why do they have to send their rules to the council for the division? And in subsection 2,
where does it say that?
Of the rules section, so that's the way JB put it, if I understood him right. In 95.2a, it says, before the council makes any rules under the section. Now, I mean, either the council's making the rules or the self-governing associations are making their own rules. And B says, if the council alters the draft rules as a result of any comments. I mean, this is certainly written as if the council takes over the governance and management of the voluntary associations as they were. And the majority of the members are the attorneys and advocates. So, I mean, this bill doesn't read the way you've described it today is very welcome, but the bill doesn't read in that fashion.
Mrs. Schaefer?
I want to discuss a few aspects of the rules, the regulations under 94. I mean, what is the intention behind the minister prescribing where the board of the Fidelity Fund can invest their money? And why is it specifically specified in government securities? Now, I mean, you can understand, given the high levels of corruption we face at the moment, why there's some concern about that provision. And also, G, what do you mean by transformational legal education? Why do you not just say legal education? That's also nothing.
All right.
Mr. Swart? Chair, I just wanted to get an understanding under 94 sub 2, whilst I appreciate the fact that the regulations will be sent to Parliament, we need to look carefully what are Parliament's powers in terms of regulations, and we might have to amend those words. As I understand it, you can either, in the present formulation, accept or reject. But say we want to accept 90% and we want to change 10%, then we can't do that. So we would just need some guidance as to how one deals with that subsidiary legislation. I know there's a committee of Parliament that's also looking at delegated legislation. But that's just a comment on sub 2. Thank you, Chair.
It's an important one. Mr. Gentry? Yes?
Yeah, look, the practice is the same as money bills. The regulations get, and I think it's working fine. I mean, it worked with the child justice regulations. I can't remember what else we had to do. But in theory, what should happen is the minister informally, before he tables, gives it to the committee to have a look at. I mean, that's what happens with a money bill. They're informally sent to the finance committee. The finance committee looks at its comments on it, and then the minister introduces it. What has happened is that the regulations have been formally tabled, and then
committee is not too happy, they get withdrawn, and the minister then reintroduces with the relevant amendment, and that works quite well. I mean, there's different levels of power over regulations. This one is a stronger provision. Presumably, it's a feeling that it's necessary because of the public interest. Otherwise, it would be tabling for noting or deemed approval or something like that. But my question was on 95, the rules issue. 95.2b. Okay, that's okay. No, I said it's draft rules. Okay. That's fine. Sorry, I thought it was that if there was an amendment to a rule, it didn't need to publish before, which would have been a bit problematic.
All right. Are you?
Yeah. Sorry. Just one other issue on the Fidelity Fund, because we've seen it's gone past. Can I just raise it?
All right, raise it, because they'll want to respond to your comments on the regulations.
Well, I think it was more mine was more an answer, but on the Fidelity Fund, there was a request for capping. What's the response on that? The Fidelity Fund came and proposed that the claim should be capped
okay.
because they were worried about running out of money. That wasn't a specific section, and I couldn't find it in the commentary, but I think it does belong in the bill. What's the response from the department on that?
All right.
Yes, there is something in the comments. I can try and find it just now.
But anyway, you know what the response is, even if you can't find it.
Yeah. I think the department doesn't have a serious problem with that. My understanding is that even the Law Society, in their comments, and I'm going to rely on this now here, said that a portion of the... let me just try and find it.
54. We stand in awe.
The department has no objection to the proposal.
Yeah,
can I just make further, I mean, this is presumably I think the Road Accident Fund is capped. Can we just put this provision in? Or would we have to, I mean, because it does limit people's rights for capping. But has the department got ideas, if not necessarily now, about procedures we would need to follow to adopt such an amendment?
We will come back to you, we'll have to come back to you on that.
Could we also maybe get an idea of what kind of claims and what value of claims there have been over the last, say, 5-10 years? And what type of matters they were for?
Talking about professional negligence where you'd be sued and there's no question of capping on that. That's a separate issue.
Okay.
This would be, why would you want to cap something where you steal a person's deposit on a house or something?
Yes.
You know, that person has lost that money. I don't know why we would want to.
Yeah.
The RAF fund is delict. It's the same. Yeah, where you've got professional negligence. It's a question of delict, negligence. So I don't know. One can look at it, but surely the consumer that places money in trust, and it's often conveyancing money that is taken, money to buy a house or something.
Yeah, but they raise the issue that if there's a huge amount, if there's like one major
crunch,
then it's
going to
wipe out the whole fund. That is
basically. Do they have it in New Zealand?
Yeah.
Do they have insurance?
Do they take out insurance against the Fidelity Fund?
they take out reinsurance, but reinsurance is extremely expensive.
Okay.
Millions and millions of rands for the premiums, and it's only up to a certain amount that they are able to be reinsured for. So that's not a foolproof mechanism.
Chair, just clarity. That's now for the fund, to cover the fund, not professional negligence. I'm talking about covering the fund. Does the fund have reinsurance?
Yes, yeah. The fund has reinsurance to protect itself in the event of claims being in excess of what it can currently hold and be liable for. So it does cover itself to that extent. But I think the concern from the fund in terms of its submission to the hearing was, what if you have one massive claim that wipes it out, and the potential for that to actually exist in the context of the fact that we're dealing with firms that have international associations, you've got multinational transactional matters that are happening with the local firms, and what happens when these multi-billion euro pound claims could go wrong and the fund is drawn into it. I'm just using that as a possible example. I'm not saying it's the only way in which it could happen.
Would the law allow, would the courts allow us to set a cap? Thinking aloud. Sorry, Mr. Schaefer, go ahead.
They have, and they're
wrong,
but never mind. Is there not also some element of professional negligence insurance by the fund? I seem to recall it is.
Chair, let me explain this very briefly. So, you have the Attorney's Fidelity Fund in the main is there to protect the public if an attorney steals your money in a very basic, gross form.
Right.
The Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund is if an attorney is negligent. So, for example, you see me to lodge your claim for a motor vehicle. I ignore prescription. I don't do it within the possible time.
Okay.
Because of my negligence, your claim wasn't even entertained. You sue me, the Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund, as my insurance company for negligence, will pay you out.
Okay.
That's the difference. So any attorney in practice that holds a Fidelity Fund certificate has an automatic cover for R1 million. And of course, it's not unusual that attorneys will take a higher cover, depending on the nature of their work, and of course they'll pay the premiums for that.
But this is clarity that is funded by the Fidelity Fund, right?
The Attorney's Fidelity Fund will cover the first million, but everything in excess of that, you will have to cover that premium.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Okay. Presumably, New Zealand has learned its lesson.
Their fund was wiped out by a single claim. What have they done? Well, maybe if it happened twice, then they didn't learn their lesson. But I mean, third time lucky. But I mean, do you know what the New Zealand law is?
I mean,
no, it's not necessarily now if you don't have it, but to get it, then
we will do the investigation.
All right. On
that aspect.
All right. Because there is a difference, eh? There's negligence, and then, as Mr. Swartz says, there's theft.
Yeah. And
if
we find that out,
I don't know what the difference would be. I mean,
well.
The case
prescribes, JJ.
Yeah, no, I know, but I mean, with both, I would have thought you need a cap.
No, but the claim of one million rand for the negligence, so that's not an issue for us because there already is a limit of a million. So you can't have a negligence. What law is that in? It's a Fidelity Fund insurance, he just said. It's in an existing law, which we are appealing or law. No, Chair, the existing bill calls for a similar type insurance, okay. Attorneys' indemnity to be provided, so it's retained.
The fund is limited contractually to R1 million.
Yeah.
The attorney can take additional fee. He'd be sued for the balance.
Okay.
Well,
well,
sorry, so won't they,
accused us of interfering in their business?
It's currently a contractual arrangement, as it currently stands. There's a fidelity fund limitation of $1 million. There's nothing in legislation that compels or provides for a limitation of
To clarify, for negligence, all that currently exists is that there is a insurance fund to cover your negligence. If your claim is 3 million rand and you've only bothered to do nothing, which means you're covered automatically for 1 million rand, then you're in trouble because you're going to be sued personally for the balance of the millions. But if you're smart and you've taken extra cover for a bad day, then you sort it out. But the point is, when you are issued with a fidelity fund certificate, a license to practice each year, you've got to renew it each year.
Mm.
Your books have to be in order. Together with the issue of that fidelity fund certificate, the fidelity fund covers you automatically for R1 million for negligence if it does arise. That's all that current takes us. If you want to take the higher amount, you pay the higher premium to the attorney's insurance indemnity fund.
The million.
I mean, the insurance is only liable for a million.
All right. The
board can't be liable for
more. All right. Okay. Hi, Mario. I see Mr. Ambrosini is leaving.
Sorry, I don't have an answer to my question on the regulation provisions regarding the legal education, transformational legal education, and why investing in government bonds is specified.
Yes, Chair, we can be guided by the committee. We don't have any specific view. They can be trained, yes, which must include whatever form of training. Look, we are checking the act. There's a current arrangement now because there's a notion that flowing from the notion that the investments that are held in both the attorney's fidelity fund and the sheriff's fidelity fund are aimed at protecting the public interest. And I know when we raised this in our discussion, there was a view that in any event, government remains, have got an interest in that process and what happens with fund on behalf of public interest at the end of the day. And that clause was put in perspective so that it's basically safe to protect the interest at some point. I know currently now that there's an arrangement through which annually or so the fund request must submit to the minister its own net liquid investment, an amount which must be retained, which must not be invested per annum. So I know that for this year the minister and we have not even found a mechanism of engaging with this process. The law said will come and say for this financial year we want to keep so much millions in our liquid fund, not for investment, whatever, subject to approval. And so this regulation basically seeks to retain what is currently practiced from the current arrangement, which seeks to protect the environment. But there could be well other mechanisms and means to protect that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessary to specify where the money must be invested. I mean, you can be satisfied that a certain amount has to be invested and maybe ensure that it's a secure fund. But I mean, for the minister to say you can invest it in that or that or that, I don't think that's the purpose. Okay. Do you agree with that?
Okay. Anything else?
The last point, I think the last fundamental matter is the transitional council process 96, if I'm not wrong, yes, 96 to powers 98, membership 99, 100, the chairperson's termination of office. I'm going to give the the broad principle from what comments were received six to suggest, and I'll ask Mr. Bassett basically to just in a very brief manner just give how the scheme of this council is going to operate, because one, most of the submissions suggest, I say most of the commentators are saying the very same comments which have been raised in respect of the council, clause 7 apply in this respect, which basically say that the minister's nominee in the transfer council need to be dealt with in the very same manner. Issue of parity between advocates and attorneys should apply in the transfer council. Issue of regulation, whatever. So the very same thing raised in respect of independence. When they commented on the National Council, they brought them back on the Transitional Council. From our perspective, Chair, and again, we have seen the Transitional Council as an important vehicle that helps bring in the intended framework, governance framework. And it is not a long-winded process. That's why, even in terms of the bill, there are set time frames within which the Transitional Council must do particular activities and conclude on them so that we can go to the next stage, etc. And therefore, it is not a permanent arrangement. And therefore, we have the view that there should, therefore, to some extent, be some form of distinction between what will be expected of the Permanent Council and the Transitional Council. And this stems from the fact that the Transitional Council seeks to complete immediate business, which will create very huge and significant gap if they are not being dealt with, and which for now are not being regulated in any other form of arrangement, etc. And answers to what point, which was raised earlier on, that what happens now. And there are many things which are falling the cracks, which we think the Transitional Council must deal with them and move on. So the focus in terms of it's the minister's role is more direct than the Permanent Council. We see in the Transitional Council the minister assuming more responsibility of closing on those aspects, whatever. So when we did the presentation with the state, for example, one of the matters is the whole issue of admission and the training requirements and pupillage. The reality is that currently there's no prescribed form of training for advocates. So basically on the basis of admission, you can go direct to court. On the basis of your qualifications, that you can get admitted and go and practice. And people's interests are basically vulnerable in the process. So we thought we cannot delay those matters for any further, because the legislation is there. We don't want to come with a process of amending only those clauses. Process in the current Advocates Act, which are basically not advancing the purpose or even promoting access to justice. We thought that the Transitional Council must have a limited function and a time frame function that can clean up the process while the entire process evolves, etc. And we indicated the bill that the department, the minister, will take the responsibility for funding its activities. It was not dependent on whatever. Would have been funded for by the profession. The minister has direct interest in the outcome of this process, and those matters are urgent and very critical at the end of the day. So that's the scheme, and this time frame then should not exist beyond a period of 24 months from whenever the bill comes into operation. There's 18 months within which it must operate, it must done its work. Then it must then hand over all its outcomes to the minister, who must then engage with parliament, minister of relations, whatever, and also set up another council, because it's transitional. We wanted to avoid a situation where a transitional come into place in perpetuity, then can't even get it out of its way. When we engage the profession, they even indicated to us that the law center of South Africa was transitional in the after 1994, but it has remained a permanent feature of the profession, pending the enactment of this bill. So those are largely the principles which guide the Transitional Council. Therefore, we feel that all the aspects of the designation of the members of the committee by the member nominee, which in this instance are only two, should be different from the Permanent Council, because if you are going to establish a long-term mechanism of appointment, whatever, it will eat into 18 months timeframe. And two, that since the Central Council, there's no election mechanism, the GCB, and that's why there's a direct recognition of the voluntary association, so that they become participant in the process of closing up and establishing a new governance framework. That GCB and all other voluntary organizations nominate people to serve in the Central Council, which is funded by the state, funded the process. But in terms of the detail of the mechanics, I'm not sure whether Mr. Bassett wants to add into the scheme of the mechanism.
All right, I see hands. Mr. Swart, Mrs. Schaefer. Yes, Mr. Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, this is a very crucial transitional council. We appreciate that you are cognizant about the concerns that we expressed about the Legal Practice Council and the appointments of the minister. I'm not saying that's something we can talk about. Just tell me, as far as the composition, I noticed that here you've got 8 attorneys and 8 advocates, whereas the final council is got 10 and 6, I think it is, 10 and 6. So it seems there must be some reason for that. And then just as far as the attorneys are concerned, is this a consensus as far as the attorneys are concerned, the representation under 96.1A Roman 1? Because obviously that composition of the various organizations, NADEL, which are already in the Law Society, it would be interested to know whether that has been agreed by the attorney's profession. If not, then one will have to look carefully how that is reached, how that representation is reached, where you've got transformation organizations that have a certain representation. If you take the numbers there, it's 4-4, which is quite an interesting, because it's almost a stalemate situation. It could be a stalemate situation. There one hopes it isn't. But I noticed that when you've got the transformation with the advocates, those forums, is one advocate, but there are less advocates, so I can understand the reasoning there. But one will have to look carefully at the composition and the numbers and to understand the rationale for the numbers. I know it's not easy. But obviously that is our task, is to look at that very carefully. And then I just wanted to ask, I suppose the wording under 96.2, regard must be given to, is exactly the same as consideration must be given to, and it's just interesting why the different wording is used. Where the Constitution says consideration must be given to, such as in 7, in constituting the council, consideration must be given to. Here it says in constitution the council, regard must be given to, but one presumes that the intention is the same. One might need to look at that for consistency's sake. Thank you.
Ms. Schaefer.
Thank you. My one question is, what happens if after the 3-year term it's provided for in 96.3, when it ceases to exist, what happens if they haven't reached agreement regarding the election procedure for constituting a new council? And various other matters, but that one particularly concerns me. Then what happens? I think that's my main concern. I also share the concern about the composition, because I mean, NADEL, BLA, and them, they all are represented in the individual law societies as it is, as far as I understand, and transformation advocates also on the GCB, but they're not just.
This is not
some clarification, please, on the terms of reference, as they are called, of the Transitional Council, which is really a sort of a powers and functions. I mean, again, it reads to me like the disestablishment of the voluntary associations. If you look at sub 2, the Transitional Council must, within 24 months of the commencement, now you've just said that after 18 months after this comes into force, they must do their work within 3 or 4 months, right? It's a hang of a lot of work. But they must, within 24 months of commencement, negotiate with and reach an agreement with the attorneys and advocates' professions, meaning what? Meaning the LSSA, meaning the GCB, meaning the other loose groupings of advocates, in respect of the transfer of their assets, rights, liabilities, obligations, and staff to the regional council. That sounds like the disestablishment of the voluntary associations to me. Then, one of the things they have to do is create a fee structure for legal practitioners, but surely not in 3 to 4 months. And also, you've just proposed the possibility of dealing with fees quite separately in a different bill. But, you know, I mean, if you think, what's the mischief? Basically, the problem now with the legal regime are costs and discipline. The public is not happy that people are being disciplined. Now, all right, so for argument's sake, we take the fee structure away. I see they also have to prepare and publish a code of conduct. These are surely what Dr. Ambrosini means by the canons he wants. So the canons are already here. But what is the purpose of the code of conduct? Currently, when a bar council or the attorneys have somebody, when they start proceedings, which end up in court with defrocking, disbarment, and all the rest, what do they do that under? Is this code of conduct supposed to be something to take the place to govern disciplinary proceedings, or are they the kind of canons that Dr. Ambrosini described? But so it seems to me that the transitional within a quite short period of time is expected to do a lot of stuff, and most of all to disestablish what exists. Now, I mean, I think the professions have told us that we must be mad to think that all the work they do, take the disciplinaries for example, that all of that can now be transferred to regional councils. What is the point? I mean, they their governance and management takes a lot of their time. And to answer me a final question, the disciplinary proceedings, those are presumably regulatory. Hmm? Yeah, that's regulatory activity. So regulation is clearly intended to go to the council and the regional councils. So you foresee a situation in which your regional councils are going to be conducting all the disciplinary stuff, right? But surely you're going to want advocates to deal with the disciplinary proceedings of advocates and attorneys with those of attorneys. And you see, I mean, I think I'm going to end up forming more firmly the position that you should have the two chambers that the GCB is talking about. Split your council then into two chambers. There are those we know who say that's not acceptable because then they're no longer voluntary organizations. But that is one possible model. So.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to make a general observations, and my colleagues will fill me through. There were discussions and engagement and negotiations on the composition, and what eventually came to a bill came out of those discussions. And I know that it's one point where even the profession asked us that they want to go and talk among themselves and they'll come back. We may not have had general consensus because I know that the issue of equal numbers, whatever, we basically argued that at the end of the day, it has a specific function, must perform within a specific time frame. So there were discussions extensive around the conversation. I have already addressed the issue of that it was never our contemplation that the assets of the voluntary association should go to regional councils. It was never, yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's one point that we have considered too, that what we will be happier with is when the bill only reflects on the assets and stuff of the law societies, because those are statutory bodies, not beyond that. because then all those aspects come into play, yes. And hence I said earlier on, we concede that this would basically be tantamount to the extinction of the GCP if you take whatever they've built among themselves, etc. There's a lot of contention around issue of discipline. Currently, voluntary associative discipline, they are members. And by some form of agreement or practice, the GCB have also taken the response of going beyond its members in terms of other aspects, etc. And our view, obviously, is that the governance structures must discipline legal practitioners, not voluntary associates at the end of the day, because that's one of their regulatory functions, etc. Obviously, if we're going to leave this on voluntary associations, the state have an interest in the discipline of legal practitioners itself. So it's one fundamental matter for discussion that we thought is a fundamental shift. And that's one of the aspects we've had alluded to earlier on, saying that whilst there's discipline being meted by GCB and whatever, etc., that must continue until such time that the regulators come into place. Otherwise, we've got indiscipline, or we don't have any measures in place to deal with it. But that is a function that the state has got a direct interest, because it is the act, it is the court that actually admits practitioners. It's the interest of the state that they must conduct themselves in a particular manner that meets the standards, the acceptable standards of the profession. And if that has not been observed, the state of interest to see that those members are disciplined at the end of the day. And that's the function which voluntary associations are carrying out. And we've kept telling them. And GCB came to us and said, but what's the main out of us if we take admission, training, and discipline at the end of the day? And we said, look, our courts admit, courts need to dismiss at the end of the day, need to have a final say on a discipline. To the extent that you are performing function now, and only in respect of your members, it's fine and good. But it's in the state itself that the functions are performed by the state, because we perform a state function, but those are the broad principles that informed our discussion around this point. But I'll request my colleagues to add on matters that I've not touched on.
Mr. Bassett and Mr. Skusana, just please bear in mind I had informally agreed that some of you should leave by 12.
Yes.
All right. Please bear that in mind.
Chair, I think there's just the one issue, the extension here, or how can everything be done in the 2 years, and what if it isn't? I think there on page 47, clause 97.5, the minister may extend the period. Yeah. So there is provision. We can.
Mr. Chair, 24 months is to be extended. They're all in 96.3. It says the duration of the transitional council is 3 years, and there's no provision to extend that.
Chair, there is provision. I'm sorry. There is a clause.
The thinking about that was to force the parties to be serious about reaching the decisions that they need to within a time frame. Otherwise, your interim structure is long-winded, it's unresolved, and it goes beyond. In fact, the department initially had a much shorter period in its first draft, as the House would know. That period was very limited, but it was extended to 3 years.
Ms. Silkstone?
If we could go to 97.5, clause 97.5.
All right, Ms. Silkstone.
I just want to know how clause 108.1b fits in.
108.1b.
Yeah.
Just really a comment. I mean, I think given that parties took how many years, 15 years, not to find each other, I think the pressure is necessary. That's just a comment. Maybe the time spans are too long, but I think it's the issue is valid around what happens if they can't reach agreement. I noticed with the arbitration, any party, would the minister also be able to be a party in that case?
954 or whatever.
Are you able to respond, Mr. Bassett?
Yeah, we'll come back on that.
All right.
Okay. But just on the last issue, right?
Including Ms. Stone's query.
Just on the last issue that was raised by Mr. Jeffrey, yes. In a version of the bill, just before this bill, the time periods were longer, and there is this urgency, as Mr. Jeffrey has said. This has been going on for years and years and years, over almost two decades now. So there is an urgency. We've got to try and come to some sort of finality. So the time periods were cut down a bit.
May I address one other aspect that we haven't touched on, but maybe in response to Honourable Smuts, that raised the issue about the UK model, and I'll be very brief. I just wanted to inform the House about the latest developments. Currently in the UK, we have about 120,000 lawyers, which they call solicitors.
Mm-hmm.
You've got about 15,000 barristers, which we call advocates.
Right.
They're regulated separately,
mm.
and there are boards, several boards that govern their codes, not just one board.
Yes, we know.
The latest position is that they want to collapse these various front-line regulators, as Honourable Smuts referred to, into a single national regulator, and they're contemplating this within 3 years. So the system is collapsing, it's not working, it's very convoluted.
Mm.
And so what they're thinking about is what we want to implement.
Yeah, but they're all, thank you. I mean, I'm aware of that precisely what's in the triennial review, but you're just telling me that's where this has progressed to. Okay, because I read the views of some institutions that it should go into one. There's a view here from another institution that it should have precisely a combined barristers and solicitors regulators in one body, but doing their separate professions. So there's more than one approach to how you compose the single one. But now I do take your point. I thought it crossed my mind also as I perused very fast that in a sense we are then leapfrogging to this. Thank you.
Those were the fundamental principles, Chair, and we can engage on the aspects of technical and on a later stage. But we will come back on the issues that we have noted from this committee.
All right, honourable members, I had informally agreed with Messrs. Bassett, Kosana, and Daya that there are members in their delegation who have to leave now, otherwise it means they must stay here until tomorrow because of flights. I know that those who are here in Cape Town will want to punish them and make them stay, but so we'll excuse them. And I'll ask you then to keep looking at the bill with a view to improving it, and we will inform you as to when next we are dealing with the bill. As I informed you yesterday, we have two matters. Three matters. thought there were two. Miles? We have the matters. No, but Unani. We only have reports here for Dumane and Miles. There's no Damas here. Yes. Yes. So we've excused the department. All right. You're welcome to stay and listen to our very interesting comments on Messrs. Miles Ndamase and Dumane. They are magistrates. All right. We'll start with Dumane. Dumane. Honorable members. Let's see. 1, 2, 3. Debbie is still here. Milani Majake is still here, so that means we have a quorum, and Mr. Jeffrey hasn't actually left. You ought to have read the report, draft report, on Mr. Magistrate C.M. Dumane. Damase, we don't have. They're busy scrambling for that, Christine.
Get the notice to send out, you know, to say that my What are we having on the 7? I'm not changing. What is it on the
7?
The person has appeared with me to see what it is by hearing on the 27.
27th is a Wednesday.
Yeah.
No, but our meeting is on Tuesday.
Yeah. No, I'm asking for permission.
For the
27th?
We won't need a quorum on the 27th. It's just a briefing.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Briefing by the AG.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. I said to you that I was going to meet in the and also maybe the budget is possible.
Let's deal with this legal practice. We'll have another one.
Only one.
Yeah, only one.
All right.
Are we ready? Honourable members,
we didn't know just now.
Yeah,
it's five a lot of them. Okay, can we?
Honourable members, can we please come to order?
I suggest to speed up. We just five a lot of them.
Mr. Spasana, our thanks go with you and to the rest of your delegation. I omitted to express my appreciation on behalf of the committee. Thank you. Thank you.
A blessed pizza.
As a Christian and a committed Christian, you shouldn't celebrate Easter. It's a pagan festival.
I know.
You know?
I'd rather speak about Christmas. Christmas is more pagan. I mean,
well,
specific.
Easter too.
Good Friday. But you know my joke, Stephen. And Dean will like sit all over me for this, and I think she's heard it before. I think. But you know, why does the I can understand why the ACDP forced the death penalty. Because where would Christianity be if
the Romans
will be upset as a good Catholic?
Well, not so good.
But it's true, if the Romans didn't have the death penalty. John. You still apologize for me
Come, honourable members, I know your reluctance to deal with these matters, and I can understand it, but it's part of our legal mandate. The case of Magistrate C.M. Dumani.
Byron.
Can I hear you, please? No, that doesn't help us. Mr. Swart.
Paragraph 4.
Yes.
5. See paragraph 4. The interim order was granted on the 21st of October. And the review application was dismissed 2 weeks earlier, 12 October. I think that should surely be the following year, but I'm presuming we need to just check that date seems wrong. Paragraph 5 was definitely wrong. And then do we normally say the commission appeared before the committee? Paragraph 6? Or do we say, you know, you've got those quality assurance magistrates, how do we normally refer to it?
Well, it is, they represent the commission.
Yeah.
So, yes.
But what do we normally write? Because when you say the commission, you then think of Judge
Oh, Lehodi.
Lehodi, yes.
I see. The disciplinary...
representatives of the commission.
Okay. All right, Christine? Disciplinary representatives of the commission, or representatives of the commission. That's in 6. And the point raised by Mr. Swart, Christine?
We just need to check that date to paragraph 5, 12 October, whether that is correct.
All right, so that's question up there. Anything else?
We don't want to put in a clause about catching that. I move the report to the office.
As amended.
As amended. Seconded, Mr. Swart?
Yes.
Agreed? All right, so that's Mr. Dumani. Mr. Jeffries, very pleased. Magistrate Miles. It's fine. What's fine? The report.
Just about a suspension.
You're not even looking at the report.
Confirms
this. Okay, I'm just a little bit worried about it. It's a bit detailed on a personal issue.
Last such as where?
Paragraph 3. The service provider reported that Ms. Miles' mental state was compromised as a result of a major depressive episode since 2009.
We've passed the mental health act yesterday.
Was that speech something else?
Which one?
About mental health act yesterday.
Was expressing his personal view, and he said that. He qualified it 3 times.
And they wouldn't be in jail.
All right. Yeah.
Separate issue.
Okay.
No, I suppose...
You want it out, Mr. Jeffrey?
No, I'll leave it.
You leave it there?
Yeah.
All right.
Unless you're supporting me.
No, I'm supporting you, Mr. Honorable Jeffrey. But maybe to just add pending what action. I don't... seem to find a pending action in this
one. Mm. No, look, this one we've spent some time with. Mm. We basically had asked the commission to investigate the question of removing her through ill health. And you know, they got an opinion and everything. So we have sort of, I think, done as much as we can. It's not helped by the fact that she wouldn't help herself.
Yeah.
That's not unusual for people suffering from depression. No, I mean, that they can't see the problem.
But then we have to help her to conclude the matter.
Yeah.
We have discussed it with the commission, but I do believe that as she gets suspended, so it doesn't continue to be a prolonged suspension, it doesn't actually end.
We might just remove her.
Well, to tell the honest fact, with me, I was thinking that today is going to be a process of removing her because we've actually dealt with this matter over a long period of time. And what I was thinking was the agreement was that we should remove her based on ill health.
She's actually being removed.
It is a removal. But there's a problem here.
Yes.
On the last page,
yes,
the bullet, it says, therefore, the commission's opinion that she is capable of carrying out her duties is justified. So that's wrong.
Incapable. Thanks, sure. You see, there are some lawyers who are incapable. Yes. The effect of this is that she's being removed. Can I hear Christine first? I've ignored her for some time, and my apologies, Ms. Silkstone. Your mic, please. No, the other button.
Sorry. With paragraph 3, perhaps we could just take out from the beginning of that paragraph to the end of pay.
To the end of?
Pay. And so we just started after considering the medical reports together with relevant information, the ethics committee formed their opinion, and so on. So take out some of that personal information.
I don't see where's
K.
K.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 line from the bottom of that paragraph. Chair, can
okay.
I ask? Can I ask when were we given these documents, these reports? I've only got it now.
No, we had them. It was emailed to us, wasn't it?
We
were distributed in the meeting yesterday.
Yeah, I wasn't in the meeting, so I'm seeing it for the first time.
No, I read it last night, the whole thing.
Well, I didn't. It wasn't emailed, so I don't have a copy of it. So that does. And what is the rush? Because the last sitting of the House is.
We can hold it over.
I think let's hold it over.
All right.
Look, it's basically I'd like to read it. I think my worry with Ms. Miles's, Magistrate Miles's one, is it's very detailed. It's then putting all her, for the whole world to see what her problem is. And it's just, in principle, a problem, Chair, that why are we getting a report like this, which is on a matter that we dealt with some time ago, at the last minute?
Hmm.
So if you weren't fortunate enough to be at the meeting, and I had other issues, as you know, you don't get the document. I don't think it was Mr. Romano, through you, Chair, you didn't email it.
No,
you didn't email it. So can we improve our system so we have some time to get the document and to properly look at it? But I think the main issue is it's not whether we adopt it today, whether we adopt it next week, whether we adopt it in 2 weeks' time. It's not going to make any difference if it's the House that has to ratify it. And can we improve? Can the Secretary please improve the systems?
All right, we'll do that. Does this one stand over, Mr. Holomisa?
Yeah, I support that, Chair. And also that...
What are you supporting?
That
it stands over. Okay.
And adding that in improving the document. For instance, if you look at the part that Christine says we must retain, it reads, after considering, which I support, after considering the medical reports together with other relevant information, the Ethics Committee formed the opinion that she does not have, I think this is in the past, this would be something like, she did not have.
No.
Yeah, and then similarly in other places where you have this confusion between the past and the present.
All right, fair enough. Okay, that justifies it then. Okay. We'll correct the language there. Then. So the question of Magistrate Miles stands over. Good.
See, I would have thought that's the more stand over. I mean, I know we should have approved Dumani and that's the first one. And I suppose it would be fine, but if we're not approving one, there's no difference to approving...
No,
anyway.
Why?
Okay, we've approved Dumani and everybody's...
I'll leave Dumani. There's no objection. It's been Ani Majaka.
Just one last addition as we continue to revise the document. To say
yeah.
It will be from... it says her attendance record show that...
Which
number
paragraph?
Three, page one.
Yes.
Page one, number three, just a line after what we're discussing with a line before. If you look at the pay that
we've agreed that all that should come out.
All that is coming out?
Yes.
But it's quite relevant.
The paragraph
that her attendance record showed that from the 1st November 2004, and then we should actually indicate to when we conclude the matter.
Right.
From 1st November 2000, she has been absent from duty for long periods of on sick leave. It should indicate when. That's very important. And then it writes 468 days, but it must indicate as to how that has been calculated.
I'm in your hand.
Mm.
So that part stays in.
Yes, why, Chair, I'm actually saying so is because if it's from 2004 to 2010 or 11, she's been absent. And now we want to remove her in 2013. And somebody might say that her condition improved afterwards. So that's why we need to actually have our dates correct as we conclude it to our removal. That's why I agree.
So the removal of the paragraph is only as far as the word information. Okay. Mr. Olamisa?
Yeah, well, Chair, I'm not sure, because I was persuaded by JJ's view that we don't want to disclose everything that led to the decision that has been taken. Because if you were to say, after considering the medical reports, then the decision was taken. Because if the person were to challenge the decision of Parliament, that's when the person will be in a position to get all the information that is contained in the first part of the
Okay, let's hold over.
Alright.
Miles and
alright.
Then
we'll think some more on it. Alright. We've not decided on this. We've agreed to stand over. Damase?
Same thing, I think, I mean, yeah.
Damase stands over?
It's shorter, but let's have a chance to read it.
Alright. Given that you've approved the standover of Ndamase as well. Honourable members, want to raise something? Yes?
I understand that the House is not sitting and therefore we can do nothing about this. But you'll recall when we met with the Commission, we expressed our concerns about their delays in finalising matters. Judge Lahori then expressed his concern in us not finalising matters. The delays that are taken with the parliamentary progress. Now, for example, the Miles case was brought to us on the 21st of August last year.
Mm.
And I think we need to try to improve, and I accept responsibility as a member of the committee as well. But it does now postpone it to the next sitting. And admittedly, we asked for more information, we asked for further legal opinion, so
yes.
It's not that it's necessarily our fault that it's been delayed, but I just wanted to make that point. Let's just be careful about, or let's just try to avoid unnecessary delays, if that is.
Well, in this case, it's unavoidable because we need a plenary for the House to accept our reports. Yeah? So it's standing over. Can we agree? There's no more plenary after today. Can we agree, honourable members, given that next week is a committee week, can we deal with these next week, please? You have the documents, so there shouldn't be any excuse. And in the meantime, Christine, if those changes can be made to it, those that have been pointed out, right?
Chair, can we try and get a better working ethic? Obviously, if we finalise something on today and we need a report, can the Smuts please, she's putting me off, can she wake up?
The Smuts.
It's the lack of oxygen, sir.
Well, I know it's terribly boring.
Uh-huh. No, it is not.
Oh.
Anyway, let me leave it. I'm past. But can we at least, if something is completed a while ago, can we get good notice of reports? Obviously, if we're dealing with something now and we're expecting the report tomorrow, then we all know it's going to be rushed. But we've been dealing with this, you know, the magistrate's issue was a few weeks ago. We threw out the Ndamase report last week. To receive it for the first time yesterday is not acceptable, particularly when if you didn't happen to be in the meeting, you didn't get it, the secretary didn't email it out.
Okay. Point taken. All right, we'll deal with this again next week, okay? Thank you.
No, I want to know what
to do
next week.
Ah, all right. All right, no. Let's hear Mr. Romano. Tuesday is a briefing on the Human Rights Commission Amendment Bill. Tuesday morning at 10 by the department, okay? Mr. Sibanyoni has pleaded with us because so many of us serve on his ad hoc committee dealing with the code of conduct and regulations for judges. Pleaded for time. We don't have plenaries next week, so we have very kindly said to him he may use our time from 2, that's after lunch, on Tuesday. But after the briefing by the department, can we conclude the matters of these magistrates, please. Alright? So that's together with the briefing by the department on Tuesday. Wednesday, we will be given a briefing by the Auditor General's office on their report on the Department of Justice. Alright? That's it?
9:30.
Nine? No. Let's make it 9. There's no meeting on Thursday next week, all right? And we will, after Wednesday, see you after the recess. That makes you pleased, Ms. Smith? Okay. All right. Thank you.
The meeting that we're going to have with I don't know if the other are available.
I was going to buy your lunch. Because you'll eat into my lunchtime if we have it now, and then I skip lunch. All right. And today it's the president.